Welcome to The Deep Dive, your shortcut to being well-informed. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Taylor Johnson, here to help us make sense of the complex and connect the dots.
Today, we're embarking on a deep dive into an absolutely fundamental document that impacts us all, often without us even realizing it. We're tackling the Federal Register for Friday, August 22nd, 2025.
That's right. And for anyone who maybe isn't super familiar, the Federal Register, it's the official daily journal of the U.S. government. It's where federal agencies publish their rules, their proposed rules, official notices.
Basically, the government's daily to-do list and legal bulletin all rolled into one.
Exactly. Think of it as the public record of how our government plans to act, how it is acting, and crucially, the legal basis for those actions.
It's published every weekday by the Office of the Federal Register. That's part of the National Archives and Records Administration, NRA.
And this isn't just a suggestion, right? It's mandated by law. The whole idea is a uniform system for making federal agency actions transparent, accessible to you.
And the content is incredibly diverse. Now, today's edition doesn't have any specific presidential proclamations or executive orders listed in our source material here, but it often does.
Right. But it does include federal agency documents with real legal effect, plus other items of public interest that Congress says must be published.
And what's really remarkable is its accessibility and, well, its legal weight. The documents are actually on file for public inspection the day before they're published.
Which is pretty amazing when you think about it.
It is. And the full text is available online, totally free, at www.govinfo.gov, updated daily by 6 a.m. Eastern. So you can literally see what the government put out that morning.
But it's more than just being available, right? The legal weight is key. The contents are judicially noticed under U.S. law.
Explain that judicially noticed part. What does that mean practically?
It means courts have to accept these documents as official and legally binding. So this isn't just, you know, dry legal text you can ignore.
Whatever.
It's the actual blueprint for how federal agencies operate. It dictates what new rules might affect businesses, public health, the environment, even your personal finances. It really is a direct window into the daily workings of government.
You can see policy being set in motion or changed right there in black and white.
Exactly. And sometimes, like a seemingly minor technical correction published today could end up meaning millions of dollars in compliance costs or savings for an entire industry down the road. The details matter.
So our mission today is clear. We're going to meticulously go through each notice, proposed rule, and rule from today's edition, August 22nd, 2025.
We'll pull out the most important nuggets, the key insights, and really discuss their impact and implications for you, the listener.
Yeah, it's about making this often dense material surprisingly digestible, maybe even, dare I say, interesting.
We can hope. Let's dive in.
Direct and immediate impacts.
Okay, let's kick things off with the rules. These are actions that are already in effect or will be very, very soon. These are the immediate impacts.
Right, the done deals, so to speak.
Yeah. First up, we have a significant move from the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN. This is aimed squarely at countering illicit finance.
Yes. This rule involves special measures prohibiting certain transmittals of funds. It targets three specific financial institutions, Cibanco S.A., Intercam Banco S.A., and Vector Casa de Bolsa, S.A. de CV.
And the context here is really important. These measures aren't coming out of nowhere.
No, they stem from what Treasury called unprecedented orders back on June 25th, 2025. And the specific target, fentanyl trafficking.
Wow. So this is serious stuff.
Absolutely. And the timeline's been shifting. The initial effective date was July 21st. Then it got pushed to September 4th.
And this rule today?
This rule further extends the effective date for all three of those orders. The new date is October 20, 2025.
Okay, so what does another extension tell us? What's the read-through here?
Well, a couple things. For the banks involved and the wider financial system, it obviously provides more time to get their ducks in a row to ensure full compliance with these fund transmittal prohibitions.
Which probably aren't simple changes to make.
Definitely not. These things require significant operational adjustments. But on the flip side, it also means the period where specific transactions involving these institutions are restricted gets longer. That has to impact their business.
Sure.
But the bigger message, I think, from FinCEN is pretty clear. They are flexing their muscles. They're using this special measures authority aggressively under powerful new mandates to fight really serious issues like fentanyl trafficking.
So it's a signal, a show of force in the financial regulation world.
I think so. And it's not just top-down orders. FinCEN is also actively inviting information from these banks or anyone else with relevant info through their website.
Interesting. So it's not a closed case. It's ongoing.
Exactly. It suggests an evolving situation, an active investigation where they're still gathering intelligence. It's a dynamic fight.
Okay. Moving from finance to the environment. Next up is the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA.
This one's labeled a technical correction. Extension of deadlines for various standards and guidelines. Well, sounds minor, maybe?
It sounds minor, but as we know, technical corrections in the Federal Register can have pretty substantial real-world effects.
Definitely. So what areas are affected here?
It extends deadlines for things like standards of performance and emissions guidelines for the oil and natural gas sector climate review. Also, national emission standards for hazardous air pollutants, NESHAPs for integrated iron and steel manufacturing, and for coke ovens.
Okay, so those are major industries. Oil and gas, steel, coke ovens. Big implications for climate, big implications for hazardous air pollutants and public health.
Absolutely. So when you see deadlines shifting for rules affecting these sectors, it's not trivial. Why do you think they'd extend these deadlines?
It could be a few reasons. Maybe the compliance itself is just really complex, technically challenging for industries to implement.
Right.
Or maybe the EPA needs more time for its own review to make sure the rules work as intended. Or perhaps industry feedback pointed out some unforeseen difficulties. It happens.
So for you listening, what's the takeaway? An extension like this means industries get more breathing room to adapt.
True. But it also could mean a delay in realizing the full environmental and public health benefits these rules were designed to achieve. It's that constant balancing act the EPA has to manage.
Okay, let's pivot to the skies. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, we've got a few airworthiness directives, ADs.
Right, ADs. These are basically non-negotiable safety mandates from the FAA. They address unsafe conditions found on aircraft. It's all about preventing accidents before they happen.
First one addresses Airbus helicopters, specifically certain EC-120 and EC-130 models. It requires installing a retaining ring.
A retaining ring. Sounds small.
It does. The estimated cost is pretty low, about 32 toulars per helicopter. And the FAA even notes some costs might be covered under warranty, which is good for operators.
Mm-hmm.
This one goes into effect really soon, August 29th, 2025.
It's a good reminder, though. Even a tiny component like a retaining ring can be absolutely critical for helicopter safety. It shows how meticulous the FAA is trying to catch potential failure points early. And the warranty mentioned is helpful context.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, another interesting AD concerns the Dassault Aviation model Falcon 10X series airplanes. This plane is pretty new, right?
Very new, cutting edge. And this AD specifically addresses novel or unusual design features that require special conditions. Makes sense for such an advanced aircraft.
So what kind of special conditions?
Things to ensure it complies with stringent requirements for exhaust emissions, noise certification, the usual environmental stuff, but applied to a new design.
Gotcha.
And this AD is considered an interim action. That means the FAA might issue more rules later as they learn more about how these novel features perform in the real world.
And it points to international cooperation, too.
Absolutely. It explicitly requires compliance with a directive from EASA, the European Union Aviation Safety Agency, though with some specific exceptions noted. Aviation safety is definitely a global game.
And here's where you, the listener, especially if you're in the industry or a pilot, can have a say. The FAA is taking comments on this AD until October 6, 2025.
That's right. It's a direct chance to provide input on the safety regulations for a brand new advanced aircraft. It's part of that balance, encouraging innovation while ensuring safety and environmental protection from day one.
That public comment period is so important.
It really is. Ensures transparency, brings in diverse expertise. We also see a couple of other ADs mentioned, one for replacing an emergency sea anchor on some unspecified aircraft, costing nearly $4,800 per unit.
Wow, that's a chunk of change.
Suggests specialized equipment, and another one for the pneumatic system on certain Airbus A321neo models, again referencing an EASA directive.
Okay, so beyond specific planes, the FAA also manages airspace. There's a correction to a final rule about airspace at Aberdeen, Maryland.
Yeah, this corrects a rule from back in June. It removes some language in the legal description of the Class E2 airspace there that apparently mistakenly indicated it was only part-time airspace.
So it clarifies it's full-time.
Exactly. Effective October 2nd. Seems minor, maybe, but in aviation, even tiny language errors matter. You need crystal clear, unambiguous airspace definitions for safety and efficiency. pilots, air traffic controllers, they rely on this precision.
Good point. Precision is key. Yep. Okay, shifting from air safety to health, animal, and human. The Food and Drug Administration, FDA, has published a rule.
This one's titled New Animal Drugs, Approval of New Animal Drug Applications, NADs. Withdrawal of approval of NADs. Change of sponsor address.
Sounds like a lot of administrative housekeeping.
It is, largely. It's a technical amendment to clean up the regulations, reflect application actions from April, May, and June 2025, and improve accuracy. But buried in the details are some important approvals.
Like what?
Well, we see approvals for several generic copies of existing animal drugs. There's moxicloprid for cats, and some compounds like monsin and vancomycin used in turkey and broiler feeds.
Generic copies. That usually means wider access and potentially lower costs, right?
That's the goal. Good news for pet owners, good news for poultry producers. It broadens access to important veterinary medicines.
Anything else stand out in the animal drug approvals?
Yes, actually. There's a supplemental approval for Credelio Quattro. This is a big one for pet owners.
Okay. What's the expansion?
The key expansion is in its indication. It's now officially indicated for the prevention of heartworm disease and for the treatment and control of roundworm, hookworm, and tapeworm.
Ah, so it covers more parasites now in one medication.
Exactly. A broader spectrum treatment. That enhances convenience for owners and provides more comprehensive care for animal health. One pill or chewable doing more work, that's a win.
Definitely simplifies things.
And there's another interesting technical amendment mentioned expanding the recognized efficacy of a different drug, a foxaliner combined with others, to include Lyme disease prevention in animals by killing the specific ticks that carry it. That's huge, given how prevalent Lyme is.
Wow, yeah. Okay, let's transition to another substantial rule. This one impacts a massive workforce directly, the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS.
Right, HHS is reissuing and revising its standards of conduct for its own employees. This is foundational stuff for ensuring ethical and effective government within a huge federal department.
It sets the rules of conduct, procedures, even disciplinary actions. What are the key changes here?
Well, a big one is a brand new subpart focused on counter-trafficking in persons requirements. This is responding directly to recent legislation.
Okay, what does it require?
The core prohibition is really strong. It explicitly bans all HHS employees from engaging in trafficking activities, not just on duty, but also during non-duty hours.
That's significant, extending ethical obligations 24/7.
It is. It's an unambiguous stance. Plus, it mandates trafficking awareness training for everyone, initial and then biennial refreshers. And it requires employees to report suspected cases or related misconduct.
So it's trying to leverage the entire HHS workforce as a line of defense against trafficking?
That's exactly the idea. Raise awareness, provide tools, mandate reporting. A comprehensive strategy.
What else is new or revised?
They've updated the political activity restrictions, reflecting changes to the Hatch Act over the years. This clarifies what commissioned officers of the Public Health Service can and cannot do politically.
Balancing civic participation with neutrality.
Precisely. It outlines permissible things, like participating in local nonpartisan elections, and clearly prohibits others, like soliciting campaign funds from subordinates.
Makes sense. How about the use of government property? That must have needed updating for the digital age.
For sure. The new rules address use of government property and information. And yes, they now explicitly allow for limited personal use of HHS IT resources, think email, maybe a quick website check.
But with limits, I assume.
Oh yeah, strict limits. It has to involve no more than minimal additional expense, be minimally disruptive, not interfere with the mission, and not violate any ethics laws. So practical, but with clear boundaries.
What about things like government cars?
Zero tolerance there. Strictly prohibits using government vehicles or aircraft for non-official purposes. Pretty standard, but reinforced here.
And finally, under the subpart on reporting misconduct, what's the scope? What do employees have to report?
It's broad. They must report information they reasonably believe indicates violations of rules or ethics, serious mismanagement, gross waste of funds, abuse of authority, or a substantial danger to public health or safety.
So it encourages whistleblowing.
It does, and it specifies the channel's supervisor, management, or directly to the inspector general for certain things. It's about internal accountability.
Okay, so those were the rules already decided, already happening, covering everything from financial crime to federal employee conduct to animal health.
Yeah, a huge range.
Yeah.
Very direct impacts.
Now, let's look at the proposals. These are the ideas currently on the table, giving us a glimpse into where policy might be heading. And this is often where public input can really make a difference. 2. proposed rules, shaping future policy. First proposed rule comes from the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, the CFPB. And this one hits close to home for anyone with a bank account or credit card. It's about data ownership and financial innovation.
Right. This proposal is digging into Section 1033 of the Dodd-Frank Act. That's the part that requires financial institutions, banks, credit unions, etc., to make your financial transaction data available to you and to authorize third parties, like budgeting apps or financial advisors you choose.
It sounds like a big step towards consumers truly owning their financial data.
It is. But it also opens up a Pandora's box of complex questions, and the CFPB is actively seeking comments on them.
Like what? What are the big sticking points?
Okay, first, they're wrestling with defining representative. The law uses the phrase agent, trustee, or representative. The CFPB is asking, does representative have to mean someone with a fiduciary duty to you?
What's the difference between an agent and a representative in this context? If there's no fiduciary duty, what guardrails are needed?
Exactly. This definition is critical. It could determine who gets access to your data. Does that third-party budgeting app act as your fiduciary? If not, what responsibilities do they have? Huge implications for data privacy, control, and accountability.
Okay, that's a big one. What else?
Defraying costs. Who pays for all this data sharing? Current rules generally stop institutions from charging fees just for setting up the data pipelines or providing the data. But Dodd-Frank itself doesn't actually say anything about cost sharing.
Ah, so it's an open question.
Very much so. The CFPB is asking, how should the burden be shared? What are the real costs for banks, especially smaller ones? Should they be allowed to recover reasonable costs, maybe with a cap?
This is a fundamental debate about market dynamics, right? Who pays for data access? Does it fall on you, the consumer, potentially limiting access, or on the institutions, maybe slowing innovation or raising other fees?
Precisely. It's about fairness and practicality in the digital age.
And then, inevitably, data security and privacy concerns.
Oh, yeah. The CFPB doesn't mince words here. They explicitly mention tens of thousands of malign actors regularly seeking to compromise data sources and transmissions.
And they point to real-world examples.
They do. They list major breaches. Yahoo, OPM, Equifax, Marriott, LinkedIn, Facebook, even the OCC just this year. It drives home the point that this isn't theoretical. Breaches are constant.
So the big risk is unintended disclosure of sensitive data by these third parties getting access.
That's a primary concern. While letting you easily move your data offers convenience and opens the door for innovative financial products, it also creates new pathways for security risks. The CFPB is trying to figure out how to strike that balance, foster innovation, but protect consumers in a world full of data breaches.
And there's a timeline update here, too.
Yes, compliance dates for data providers have been stayed by 90 days. The first compliance date is now pushed back to June 30, 2026.
So overall, a crucial proposal aiming for consumer data ownership, but grappling with really fundamental questions on security, cost, and legal definitions. Public input here could really shape the future of how your financial data is handled.
Absolutely. It's a foundational piece of modern finance regulation.
Okay, let's shift gears. Another significant proposed rule, this time from the Bureau of the Fiscal Service at the Department of the Treasury. This one's titled Notice of Proposed Rulemaking on the Public Dissemination of the Identity of a Delinquent Debtor. That sounds, well, intense.
It is pretty direct.
Yeah.
This proposal would basically give federal agencies and potentially states, too, the authority to publicly identify individuals who are delinquent on debts owed to the government.
Publicly identify them, like publish their name.
Potentially, yes. It's proposed as a tool to incentivize payment, a form of public pressure.
Okay, but surely there are conditions. They can't just name anyone who owes money.
No, there are specific conditions laid out. The debt has to be delinquent, obviously. The amount has to be fixed and certain. There can't be an existing payment plan or settlement agreement in place. And importantly, the agency has to determine the debtor is unable or unwilling to pay.
And what information could they publish?
The proposal outlines the debtor's name, any known aliases, full or partial physical or mailing address, even professional titles like doctor or attorney.
Wow. What about social security numbers?
Generally not included, the proposal says, unless legally authorized elsewhere. Other taxpayer IDs, TINs, might be permitted, though. They can also state that a debt is owed and delinquent, the amount, how long it's been delinquent, and provide contact info for the agency.
My immediate thought is, what if they get it wrong? What if they identify the wrong person or the information is inaccurate?
That's the really tricky part. The proposal says if an agency incorrectly identifies someone or publishes materially adverse, inaccurate info, they must issue a retraction or correction within a reasonable time if requested.
Okay, so there's a correction mechanism.
Yes, but, and this is a huge but, the rule explicitly states it's not intended to impose any liability on the agency for incorrect identification, inaccurate information, or even accurate information that harms a third party.
Wait, seriously, no liability. So they can potentially ruin someone's reputation by mistake and face no legal consequences for it.
That's what the proposed language suggests. They'll correct the record, but they're trying to shield the agency from being sued over the damage caused by the error.
That feels unbalanced. It gives agencies a powerful, potentially reputation-damaging tool, but removes a key form of accountability if they misuse it or make mistakes.
It definitely raises significant privacy concerns and questions about due process. It's a stark trade-off between the government's interest in collecting debt and individual rights. The lack of liability is a major point of contention.
A powerful tool indeed. Okay, moving on to the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. They've got a few proposed rules cooking.
First up is the poll attachment formula rate. Sounds super technical.
It is technical, but important. It's about the formula used to calculate how much companies, like broadband providers or cable companies, have to pay to attach their wires to utility poles, which are often owned by electric companies.
Ah, so it directly impacts the cost of deploying things like broadband internet.
Exactly. The formula includes elements for administrative costs, maintenance, depreciation. Tweaking that formula can shift significant costs between the pole owners and the attachers.
And that affects competition, deployment speed, maybe even consumer prices down the line.
Right. The FCC explicitly invites small businesses to comment on this, recognizing the impact it could have on them. It's a core piece of infrastructure policy.
Okay, what else from the FCC?
They're looking at truth in billing rule modernization. This is about the rules governing how your phone and internet bills look and what information they have to contain.
Trying to make bills understandable. Weren't those rules originally meant to stop things like slamming and cramming?
They were. Slamming being unauthorized carrier changes, cramming being unauthorized charges stuffed onto your bill. But the FCC is now suggesting those harms are no longer a significant consumer issue.
Really? They think cramming is gone.
That seems to be their perspective in this proposal. And they argue the current rules may stifle innovation and impose unnecessary regulatory burdens.
So what are they proposing to get rid of?
Things like the requirement for a separate section on your bill just for third-party charges, the requirement for specific contact info, the requirement for providers to notify you about blocking third-party charges.
So the argument is less regulation might lead to more innovative billing, maybe better digital presentation.
That's the idea. But the flip side is potentially less transparency, fewer built-in consumer protections against confusing bills or unwanted charges.
It's that classic trade-off again. Do the reduced risks of slamming and cramming justify potentially less clear billing? The FCC wants comments on that.
Yeah, it's a direct question for consumers and consumer groups.
And one more from the FCC. A further notice of proposed rulemaking on broadcast radio service, BRS Spectrum.
BRS Spectrum, what's that used for?
A couple of key things mentioned here. One is air ground radio telephone service, basically, providing wireless services like broadband to aircraft in flight.
Ah, in-flight Wi-Fi.
Could be part of it. The other is educational broadband service, EBS. This uses microwave frequencies for things like transmitting video programming or providing two-way high-speed data, often for schools and educational institutions, sometimes as an alternative to wired cable.
So decisions about how this BRS spectrum is used affect air travel connectivity and educational services, especially maybe in rural areas.
Yeah, exactly. It's about managing a valuable public resource, the airwaves, to support both commercial services and public interest goals like education.
Okay, let's move from the airwaves to the oceans. The National Marine Fisheries Service, NMFS, part of NOAA.
Right. NMFS has a proposed rule to implement an international agreement specifically, a binding recommendation from ICCAT, the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas.
And this one concerns
mobile rays. That includes manta rays and devil rays. Very charismatic, but also vulnerable species.
So what's the proposed action?
It would prohibit fishermen in Atlantic, highly migratory species, HMS fisheries, think tuna, swordfish, sharks, from attaining any mobulid rays they accidentally catch.
So catch and release only?
Essentially, yes. It requires them to be released unharmed and even implements specific safe handling practices for vessels using certain gear, like pelagic longlines. This aligns with broader goals of minimizing bycatch and protecting endangered species like the giant manta ray.
How does NMFS see this impacting the fishing industry economically?
They anticipate the impact will be neutral for small fishing businesses. Why? Because mobulid rays are already considered bycatch. They aren't targeted, they aren't typically kept, and there's basically no market or recorded sales for them.
So it formalizes existing practice, more or less, while adding handling rules.
Pretty much. It solidifies a non-retention policy and adds those handling requirements, which might need some adaptation or training, but shouldn't disrupt the economics of the fisheries as they operate now. Comments are due September 22nd.
Okay, now for a proposal that could ripple through thousands of businesses across almost every sector, the Small Business Administration, SBA.
Yes, the size standards changes. This is always a big one.
It really is. The SBA is proposing to revise its size standards. That's the official definition of what qualifies as a small business for government purposes. This determines eligibility for federal contracts, loans, regulatory relief. It's huge.
And they have to do this periodically, right? By law?
Yep. They review all size standards every 5 years based on their methodology, which itself was recently revised. They look at industry structure, average firm size, competition, entry barriers, and also federal contracting data, like the share of contracts going to small businesses.
So let's get specific. What are some examples of proposed changes?
Okay. One interesting one is forest fire suppression and management services. The current standard is $34 million in annual receipts. They're proposing to decrease it to $20 million.
A decrease? That seems unusual given recent trends. Why?
Their rationale mentions excluding very large firms from the analysis and notes that the lower standard better reflects the specialized, often smaller nature of many fire suppression operations, think crews of 1820 firefighters. They acknowledge the inherent uncertainty and recent surges in forest fire incidents, suggesting this aims to ensure truly small, specialized outfits can compete for these critical contracts.
Interesting. So targeting the support more narrowly in that specific sector, what about financial institutions, banks, and credit unions?
Currently, the standard is $850 million in assets. Their analysis calculated higher figures, closer to $920, $950 million, depending on the type.
So they're proposing an increase?
Yes. They propose to increase the common size standard to $925 million in assets for depository institutions, credit unions, and related financial industries.
That's a significant jump. What's the impact? It acknowledges growth in the financial sector and means more. Larger institutions would qualify as small for SBA programs. This could potentially impact lending competition and access to capital, especially for those newly qualifying institutions. They're also asking if they should keep one common standard or maybe set separate ones for banks versus credit unions.
So some decreases like firefighting, some increases like banking. What's the overall picture?
Overall, out of 513 monetary-based size standards reviewed, the SBA proposes to increase 263, retain 249, meaning no change, and remove one exception. Only that one proposed decrease for fire suppression stands out.
So the overwhelming trend is either increase or keep the same.
Exactly. And this reflects a stated SBA policy adopted after the 2008 financial crisis and reinforced during the pandemic. Generally not lowering size standards, even if their raw analysis might suggest it, unless a firm is truly dominant.
Why the reluctance to lower standards?
The rationale is usually about providing stability and support, not pulling the rug out from under businesses that currently qualify as small and rely on that status, especially after economic shocks.
But what if they did strictly follow the analysis? What would happen if they lowered standards where the data suggested it?
They actually analyzed that, calling it alternative option one. If they adopted all calculated standards, including decreases, they estimate about 7,882 currently small businesses would lose their small status.
Wow, nearly 8,000 businesses. What's the financial impact?
It would lead to an estimated $2 billion annual reduction. That's about 3.4% in federal contracts awarded to small businesses. Construction and professional scientific technical services would be hit hardest.
That's a massive potential impact. So the SBA's choice to generally not decrease standards is a major policy decision with billions of dollars at stake.
Absolutely. It shows a clear choice to support the existing pool of small businesses, even if it means the definition of small keeps creeping up in many sectors. It's a constant balancing act.
Okay. We've covered the rules already in place and the proposed rules shaping the future. Now let's move to the notices. These are more like announcements, updates, requests for information. but still full of important insights.
Announcements and updates.
Kicking off the notices section, we have a lot of action from the International Trade Administration, ITA, at the Department of Commerce, mostly related to enforcing trade rules.
Right. These are about anti-dumping and countervailing duties, ADCVD, tools used to combat unfairly priced imports or imports subsidized by foreign governments.
First, they've initiated circumvention inquiries for paper plates from China. But the twist is, these plates are being finished in Cambodia and Malaysia using paperboard made in China.
Ah, the classic circumvention scenario. Trying to dodge duties by doing the final assembly step in a third country. ITA has specific criteria to determine if that's what's happening. Like, is it the same kind of product? Is the value add in the third country minor? Is most of the value still coming from China?
So this is about closing loopholes in existing trade orders.
Exactly. It impacts global supply chains and aims to keep the playing field level for U.S. producers. We also see routine administrative reviews mentioned, like preliminary results for citric acid from Belgium and finished carbon steel flanges from Spain.
Anything notable in those reviews?
The Spanish flange review preliminarily found zero dumping margin. That's good news for the Spanish exporter, ULMA Forja, suggesting they're pricing fairly in the U.S. market. Reduces uncertainty for importers.
Okay, and then there's a big new investigation being launched.
Yes, initiation of AD and CVD investigations for unwrought palladium from Russia, based on a petition from Stillwater Mining Company and a union.
Palladium. That's using catalytic converters, right? And jewelry.
Critical metal, yes.
Oh.
And Russia is a major producer. The allegations are the usual. Sales at less than fair value, dumping,
right,
and receiving unfair government subsidies, both causing injury to the U.S. industry.
And Russia's status as a non-market economy complicates things.
It does. It means commerce doesn't use Russian domestic prices to determine fair value. Instead, they use factors of production, like labor, energy, raw materials, and value them in a comparable surrogate market economy country.
Which country are they proposing as the surrogate here?
The petitioners suggested Malaysia for most inputs, and Romania specifically for valuing the precious metals involved palladium, platinum, rhodium. Parties can comment on that choice.
So this could lead to significant duties on a critical metal from a major global player.
Absolutely. Big implications for automotive and other industries, and it highlights ongoing trade tensions. This is a major investigation to watch.
We also see initiation of reviews for tires from Vietnam and steel staples from China, and final results for steel blocks from Italy. ITA is definitely busy.
Trade enforcement is a constant process. And they also published a list of scope rulings decisions clarifying exactly what products are covered by existing orders. For example, they ruled ceramic roofing tiles imported as a kit are not covered by the order on regular ceramic tile from China. Details matter.
Okay, let's shift from trade to public health again. Notices from the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, some interesting ones from the CDC.
Yeah, the CDC is actually rescinding several old import restrictions or embargoes.
Rescinding, like getting rid of them.
Exactly. First, they're lifting a 2001 embargo that prohibited importing Dracaena plants like Lucky Bamboo in standing water.
Lucky Bamboo, why was that ever banned?
To prevent the introduction of the Asian tiger mosquito. It can breed in small amounts of water, like that used for shipping plants, and it carries nasty diseases like dengue, Zika, West Nile.
So why lift the ban now? Did the risk go away?
Several reasons. First, the industry worked with the CDC to develop safer packaging using hydrogel instead of standing water, using pesticides, better facility controls. Second, and crucially, the CDC says the Asian tiger mosquito is now endemic in the United States.
Meaning it's already here and widespread.
Right. So continuing the import ban would have only marginal public health benefit. It's a great example of policy catching up with science and industry innovation.
Are there other rescissions?
Yes. They're also lifting a 1981 advisory that banned importing Haitian goatskin handicrafts. Again, the rationale is the marginal public health benefit does not outweigh the potential burden on importers.
And one more.
Lifting an embargo on importing civets and related animals.
Yeah.
Family Viviridae. The CDC determined the requirements are no longer necessary to protect the public's health.
Weren't civets linked to SARS?
They were back in the day.
Mm.
So lifting this suggests a careful reevaluation of current threats and existing controls. It's all about updating policies based on current risk assessments.
Also from HHS, the Office of Child Support Enforcement, OCSE, is asking for comments on revising their big survey.
Yeah, the Current Population Survey Child Support Supplement. This collects vital data on child support agreements, payments, family characteristics. It helps OCSE oversee the program and helps lawmakers evaluate policies. They're just updating the questions to keep it relevant.
And the FDA has several notices about extending information collections routine, but necessary for things like food export certifications, monitoring flu diagnostic tests, tobacco retailer training guidance, and animal food safety standards.
All important for trade, public health, and food safety oversight.
And finally, from HHS, a call for nominations for a new advisory committee. The HHS National Advisory Committee on Make America Healthy Again.
This sounds like a potentially influential group. Its mission is to advise the HHS secretary on improving health outcomes, reducing costs, and promoting innovation.
What specific areas will they focus on?
Key objectives mentioned include developing a real-time data system for healthcare, improving Medicaid quality, and ensuring Medicare Advantage sustainability, including modernizing risk adjustment. They're looking for nominees with practical experience, advocacy skills, credibility, and they specifically emphasize wanting diverse viewpoints, geographic representation, and demographic diversity.
So this committee could shape some major health policy reforms.
Definitely one to watch for anyone in the healthcare space. Their recommendations could carry significant weight.
Okay, moving on to the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, covering maritime, cyber, and emergency management.
First, the Coast Guard. Just routine notices asking for extensions on information collections needed for maritime safety things. Things like inspecting liquid cargo transfers. Essential safety paperwork.
Then, from CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, an update on Software Bill of Materials, SBM Minimum Element.
This is really important stuff in the cybersecurity world. SBOMs are like ingredient lists for software. They tell you what components are inside a software product.
Why is that important?
Crucial for managing vulnerabilities.
Yeah.
If a flaw is found in a common software library, like Log4j a while back, organizations need SBOMs to quickly identify which of their systems use that vulnerable component.
Ah, so it helps with patching and risk management?
Exactly. These new 2025 minimum elements from CESA update the original 2021 standards, reflecting improvements in SBOM tools and implementation maturity. They want feedback on whether these new minimums are feasible across different sectors and technologies.
So CISIS is pushing for more transparency in the software supply chain to boost cybersecurity.
That's the goal. It impacts how software is built, bought, and secured across the board.
And FEMA has a notice about revising their Ask the Advocate web form for the National Flood Insurance Program to streamlining communication there.
Makes sense. Helping people navigate flood insurance is important work.
Well, let's turn to the Department of the Interior. Land, Wildlife, Cultural Heritage. First, the Fish and Wildlife Service, FWS.
This is a big one. A notice about a draft environmental impact statement for the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative, KIUC, Habitat Conservation Plan. HCP in Hawaii.
Habitat Conservation Plan, what's that involve?
KIUC, the utility co-op, is seeking a 50-year incidental take permit. This would allow them to potentially harm or harass individuals of federally listed, threatened, and endangered species incidentally during their normal operations, power line maintenance, facility lighting, even during their conservation efforts.
So 50 years is a long time. What species are covered?
A heartbreakingly beautiful list of unique Hawaiian wildlife. Several seabirds like the Newell's shearwater, Iau, and Hawaiian petrel, Uau, the Hawaiian stilt, Hawaiian duck, Kaloa mauli, coot, gallinule, the Nona goose, and even the green sea turtle, Honu.
Wow, so the plan has to outline how they'll minimize and mitigate that potential harm.
Exactly. The HCP includes detailed measures to avoid, minimize, and mitigate impacts, plus monitoring, adaptive management, and funding commitments. The FWS is comparing this proposed action, issuing the permit, the HCP, to no action. No permit, no mitigation. They prefer the proposed action.
And they're seeking public comment.
Yes, on biological data, potential effects, socioeconomic impacts, cultural uses, cumulative effects. A public meeting is planned too. It's a huge balancing act between essential infrastructure and protecting incredibly vulnerable species in a unique ecosystem.
A very complex situation. Also from Interior via the National Park Service, NPS, we have three notices under NAGPRA.
The Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. These are notices of intended repatriation.
Meaning institutions intend to return items to tribes.
Correct. We see notices from the University of Iowa planning to return remains of at least 40 individuals and associated objects from Lamar County sites. The University of North Dakota returning objects of cultural patrimony. And the Kalamazoo Valley Museum in Michigan returning a sacred object of cultural patrimony.
These are significant steps in honoring tribal rights and heritage.
Absolutely. Each notice represents a long process of consultation and signifies the ongoing work of repatriation mandated by NADGPRA. The returns are scheduled to happen on or after September 22nd.
Okay, let's look at the Department of Labor, DOL, Benefits and Worker Safety. First, EBSA, the Employee Benefits Security Administration.
And this is that fascinating case we touched on earlier. The proposed exemption for certain prohibited transactions involving the Mid-America Carpenters Regional Council Apprentice and Training Fund in St. Louis.
Right. The fund wants to sell property to the related regional council, which would normally be a prohibited transaction under ERISA, the law protecting employee benefit plans.
And the history is messy. The fund bought land, spent millions renovating it into a training center. The council leases space there. Then the council wanted to buy it.
But the council jumped the gun and started building a wellness center on the property before buying it and without paying the fund.
Exactly. That created huge ERISA problems, potential self-dealing fiduciary breaches. It led to earlier exemption applications being tentatively denied and required a settlement between the council and EBSA enforcement.
So this new application is trying to do it right, prospectively.
Yes, with an independent fiduciary overseeing things. And the proposed conditions are strict to protect the training fund.
What are the key conditions?
The fund must receive the greater of $220,000, or the fair market value at the time of sale, notably $50,000 more than the original offer. An independent appraiser sets the FMV. The sale must be cash, one time, and close within 90 days of the final exemption.
So, lots of safeguards built in this time.
EBSA is making sure the fund's participants and beneficiaries are protected financially. It's ERISA in action, preventing potential abuse of plan assets.
Also from DOL, OSHA notices about worker safety certifications.
Right. These relate to nationally recognized testing laboratories, or NRTLs. OSHA recognizes these labs to independently test and certify workplace products for safety.
We see DECRA certification applying to expand its scope, adding 32 test standards, and Intertech testing services getting final approval for an expansion.
This is good for manufacturers and workers. More accredited testing capacity means more options for getting products certified, which ultimately contributes to safer workplaces.
Okay, quick stops at the Federal Railroad Administration, FRA, at DOT.
They're collecting information related to waivers or modifications for positive train control, PTC systems, the critical collision avoidance tech. Routine, but important for managing the system.
And the Long Island Railroad, LIRR, has submitted a request to temporarily disable its PTC system. Why?
To allow for installation and testing of modifications to the system transponders, interface units, the back office map. They need to turn it off briefly to upgrade it safely.
Sounds like a necessary step, but disabling a safety system, even temporarily, requires oversight.
Absolutely. FRA is taking comments on LIRR's request. It highlights the ongoing work needed to maintain and improve these complex safety systems.
Just a few more departments. Department of Justice, DOJ.
Notice of a meeting for the Religious Liberty Commission, an advisory committee established by executive order. Open to the public, meeting at the Museum of the Bible in D.C., addresses policy related to religious freedom.
The State Department.
Several notices. Two, determining that objects imported for art exhibitions, ULOC, passages and lines of resolution, are culturally significant, facilitating cultural exchange. Also, a delegation of authority related to the Naval Small Craft Instruction School.
And crucially, OFAC sanctions updates from Treasury, though often published by state too.
Right. The Office of Foreign Assets Control. This notice confirms two Iranian individuals remain blocked under WMD proliferation sanctions.
But there are removals, too.
Yes, this is noteworthy. Gabriel Portapara of Colombia and four related Colombian companies were unblocked and removed from the SDN list back in July.
So sanctions aren't always permanent.
No. This suggests a change in circumstances or behavior that led OFAC to lift the designation. It shows the system can respond with real economic consequences for those involved.
Almost there. Surface Transportation Board, STB.
They determined railroad revenue adequacy for 2024, a key financial health indicator for freight rail. And they're tentatively approving the acquisition of Beeline Tours LTD by Trax America Inc., two motor passenger carriers in the Seattle market. STB reviews these for impacts on competition, service, and employees.
And finally, a few quick hits from NASA, NRC, PRC, and Dotimo.
NASA announced its Senior Executive Service Performance Review Board members. NRC noted no commission meeting scheduled for the next 2 weeks. PRC gave notice about competitive service agreements from the Postal Service. And DOT summarized the agenda for an upcoming International Maritime Organization meeting covering things like alternative fuels, ammonia, container safety, and reducing GHG emissions from ships.
Wow, that covers a lot of ground from just one day's Federal Register retro.
Yeah.
Wow, what a journey through the Federal Register for August 22, 2025. I mean, from the tiny details of helicopter retaining rings to the absolutely sweeping implications of financial data ownership and global trade disputes over palladium.
Yeah, it really hits you. Even a single day's edition is just packed with decisions, big and small, that genuinely shape our world.
We saw those critical extensions in FinCEN's fight against fentanyl trafficking, important updates or delays in environmental standards for major industries.
And that fascinating FDA activity expanding access to generic animal drugs, which is great, but also fine-tuning rules for really complex medications and even recognizing new preventative treatments like for Lyme disease in pets. The sheer scope of federal oversight is... well, it's impressive.
It really is. And those proposed rules really gave us a peek into the future, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
The CFPB wrestling with data privacy versus innovation and cost. That really bold, maybe controversial Treasury proposal to publicize delinquent debtors.
Yeah, that one definitely raises eyebrows.
And the SBA's really thoughtful ongoing reevaluation of what small business even means in today's economy. These aren't just abstract debates. They have profound implications for millions of Americans and businesses.
Absolutely. And the notices, too, they weren't just filler. Critical trade investigations into palladium from Russia, paper plates via Southeast Asia, then rescinding those decades-old public health embargoes on Lucky Bamboo and civets.
Right. Shows adaptation.
Exactly. And the ongoing efforts to repatriate Native American cultural items under NOGPRA. It all underscores how dynamic these agencies are, or at least strive to be, reacting to new information, new laws, societal changes, even if most of it flies under the public radar.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, here's maybe something to chew on. How many of these subtle changes, these seemingly minor details, published today, August 22nd, 2025, how many will ripple outwards and significantly impact your life or the lives of people around you, maybe months or even years from now?
It's a good question. That unseen hand of federal regulation, it's always moving, always shaping things, whether we notice it day to day or not.
Thank you for joining us on this exploration. We hope this deep dive has given you a clearer understanding, maybe a better feel, for the daily pulse of federal governance.
For Alex Smith and Taylor Johnson, this has been The Deep Dive.
Until next time, stay curious and stay informed.